Chapter 14. Trying to look like me, I don't blame them for that. These are only emblematic of his character, and that is all. I say, without exception, hair and all, he is the whitest man I have ever known. The old-fashioned printer address at the Topathy dinner given at Delmonico's, January 18, 1886, commemorating the birthday of Benjamin Franklin, Mr. Clemens responded to the toast, "He compositor." The chairman's historical reminiscences of Gutenberg have caused me to fall into reminiscences, for I myself am something of an antiquity. All things change in the procession of years, and it may be that I am among strangers. It may be that the printer of today is not the printer of 35 years ago. I was no stranger to him. I knew him well. I built his fire for him in the winter mornings. I brought his water from the village pump. I swept out his office. I picked up his type from under his stand. And, if he were there to see, I put the good type in his case, and the broken ones among the yell matter, and if he wasn't there to see, I dumped it all with the eye on the imposing stone, for that was the furtive fashion of the cub, and I was a cub. I wetted down the paper Saturdays, I turned it Sundays, for this was a country weekly. I rolled, I washed the rollers, I washed the forms, I folded the papers, I carried them around at dawn Thursday mornings. The carrier was then an object of interest to all the dogs in town. If I had saved up all the bites I ever received, I could keep M. Pasteur busy for a year. I enveloped the papers that were for the mail. We had 100 town subscribers and 350 country ones. The town subscribers paid in groceries, and the country ones in cabbages and cordwood when they paid at all, which was merely sometimes, and then we always stated the fact in the paper, and gave them a puff, and if we forgot it, they stopped the paper. Every man on the town list helped edit the thing, that is, he gave orders as to how it was to be edited, dictated its opinions, marked out its course for it, and every time the boss failed to connect he stopped his paper. We were just infested with critics, and we tried to satisfy them all over. We had one subscriber who paid cash, and he was more trouble than all the rest. He bought us once a year, body and soul, for $2. He used to modify our politics every which way, and he made us change our religion 4 times in 5 years. If we ever tried to reason with him, he would threaten to stop his paper, and, of course, that meant bankruptcy and destruction. That man used to write articles a column and a half long, leaded long primer, and sign them Junius, or Aretas, or Ox Populi, or some other high-sounding rot. And then, after it was set up, he would come in, and say he had changed his mind, which was a gilded figure of speech, because he hadn't any, and order it to be left out. We couldn't afford Ogus in that office, so we always took the leads out, altered the signature, credited the article to the rival paper in the next village, and put it in. Well, we did have one or two kinds of Ogus. Whenever there was a barbecue, or a circus, or a baptizing, we knocked off for half a day, and then to make up for short matter we would earn over ads, turn over the whole page and duplicate it. The other ogus was deep philosophical stuff, which we judged nobody ever read. So we kept a galley of it standing, and kept on slapping the same old batches of it in, every now and then, till it got dangerous. Also, in the early days of the telegraph we used to economize on the news. We picked out the items that were pointless and barren of information and stood them on a galley and changed the dates and localities and used them over and over again till the public interest in them was worn to the bone. We marked the ads, but we seldom paid any attention to the marks afterward. So the life of a D-ad and a F-ad was equally eternal. I have seen a D-notice of a sheriff's sale still booming serenely along 2 years after the sale was over, the sheriff dead, and the whole circumstance become ancient history. Most of the yearly ads were patent medicine stereotypes, and we used to fence with them. I can see that printing office of prehistoric times yet, with its horse bills on the walls, its quote boxes clogged with tallow, because we always stood the candle in the quote box nights, its towel, which was not considered soiled until it could stand alone, and other signs and symbols that marked the establishment of that kind in the Mississippi Valley. And I can see, also, the tramping car, who flitted by in the summer, on Terry Day, with his wallet stuffed with one shirt and a hatful of handbills. For if he couldn't get any type, who said he would do a temperance lecture? His way of life was simple, his needs not complex. All he wanted was plate and bed and money enough to get drunk on, and he was satisfied. But it may be, as I have said, that I am among strangers, and sing the glories of a forgotten age to unfamiliar ears, so I will make even and stop. Society of American Authors, on November 15, 1900, the Society gave a reception to Mr. Clemens, who came with his wife and daughter. So many members surrounded the guests, that Mr. Clemens asked : is this genuine popularity, or is it all a part of a prearranged program? Mr. Chairman, ladies, and gentlemen, it seems a most difficult thing for any man to say anything about me that is not complimentary. I don't know what the charm is about me which makes it impossible for a person to say a harsh thing about me, and say it heartily, as if he was glad to say it. If this thing keeps on, it will make me believe that I am what these kind chairmen say of me. In introducing me, Judge Ransom spoke of my modesty, as if he was envious of me. I would like to have one man come out flat-footed, and say something harsh and disparaging of me, even if it were true. I thought at one time, as the learned judge was speaking, that I had found that man, but he wound up, like all the others, by saying complimentary things. I am constructed like everybody else, and enjoy a compliment as well as any other fool, but I do like to have the other side presented. And there is another side. I have a wicked side. Estimable friends who know all about it would tell you, and take a certain delight in telling you things that I have done, and things further that I have not repented. The real life that I live, and the real life that I suppose all of you live, is a life of interior sin. That is what makes life valuable and pleasant. To lead a life of undiscovered sin, that is true joy. Judge Ransom seems to have all the virtues that he ascribes to me. But, oh my, if you could throw an x-ray through him. We are a pair. I have made a life study of trying to appear to be what he seems to think I am. Everybody believes that I am a monument of all the virtues, but it is nothing of the sort. I am living two lives, and it keeps me pretty busy. Someday there will be a chairman who will forget some of these merits of mine, and then he will make a speech. I have more personal vanity than modesty, and twice as much veracity as the two put together. When that fearless and forgetful chairman is found, there will be another story told. At the press club recently, I thought that I had found him. He started in the way that I knew I should be painted with all sincerity, and was leading to things that would not be to my credit. But when he said that he never read a book of mine, I knew at once that he was a liar, because he never could have had all the wit and intelligence with which he was blessed, unless he had read my works as a basis. I like compliments. I like to go home and tell them all over again to the members of my family. They don't believe them, but I like to tell them in the home circle, all the same. I like to dream of them if I can. I thank everybody for their compliments, but I don't think that I am praised any more than I am entitled to be. Reading room opening on October 13, 1900, Mr. Clemens made his last address preceding his departure for America at Kensal Rise, London. I formally declare this reading room open, and I think that the legislature should not compel a community to provide itself with intelligent food, but give it the privilege of providing it, if the community so desires. If the community is anxious, to have a reading room, it would put its hand in its pocket and bring out the penny tax. I think it a proof of the healthy, moral, financial, and mental condition of the community if it taxes itself for its mental food. A reading room is the proper introduction to a library, leading up through the newspapers and magazines to other literature. What would we do without newspapers? Look at the rapid manner in which the news of the Galveston disaster was made known to the entire world. This reminds me of an episode which occurred 15 years ago, when I was at church in Hartford, Connecticut. The clergyman decided to make a collection for the survivors, if any. He did not include me among the leading citizens who took the plates around for collection. I complained to the governor of his lack of financial trust in me, and he replied, "Colin, I would trust you myself if you had a bell punch. You have paid me many compliments, and I like to listen to compliments. I understand your chairman has said to you about the Union of England and America. He also alluded to my name, of which I am rather fond. A little girl wrote me from New Zealand in a letter I received yesterday, stating that her father said my proper name was not Mark Twain but Samuel Clemens, but that she knew better, because Clemens was the name of the man who sold the patent medicine, and his name was not Mark. She was sure it was Mark Twain, because Mark is in the Bible and Twain is in the Bible. I was very glad to get that expression of confidence in my origin, and as I now know my name to be a scriptural one, I am not without hopes of making it worthy." Literature, address at the Royal Literary Fund Banquet, London, May 4, 1900. Anthony Hope introduced Mr. Clemens to make the response to the toast literature. Mr. Hope has been able to deal adequately with this toast without assistance from me. Still, I was born generous. If he had advanced any theories that needed refutation or correction, I would have attended to them, and if he had made any statements stronger than those which he is in the habit of making, I would have dealt with them. In fact, I was surprised at the mildness of his statements. I could not have made such statements if I had preferred to, because to exaggerate is the only way I can approximate to the truth. You cannot have a theory without principles. Principles is another name for prejudices. I have no prejudices in politics, religion, literature, or anything else. I am now on my way to my own country to run for the presidency, because there are not yet enough candidates in the field, and those who have entered are too much hampered by their own principles, which are prejudices. I propose to go there to purify the political atmosphere. I am in favor of everything everybody is in favor of. What you should do is to satisfy the whole nation, not half of it, for then you would only be half a president. There could not be a broader platform than mine. I am in favor of anything and everything of temperance and intemperance, morality and qualified immorality, gold standard and free silver. I have tried all sorts of things, and that is why I want to buy the great position of ruler of a country. I have been in turn reporter, editor, publisher, author, lawyer, burglar. I have worked my way up, and wish to continue to do so. I read today in a magazine article that Christendom issued last year 55,000 new books. Consider what that means. 55,000 new books meant 54,000 new authors. We are going to have them all on our hands, to take care of sooner or later. Therefore, double your subscriptions to the Literary Fund. Disappearance of Literature, address at the dinner of the 19th Century Club, at Sherry's, New York, November 20, 1900, Mr. Clemens spoke to the toast, "The Disappearance of Literature." Dr. Gould presided, and in introducing Mr. Clemens said that he, the speaker, when in Germany, had to do a lot of apologizing for a certain literary man who was taking what the Germans thought undue liberties with their language. "It wasn't necessary for your chairman to apologize for me in Germany. It wasn't necessary at all. Instead of that, he ought to have impressed upon those poor benighted Teutons the service I rendered them. Their language had needed untangling for a good many years. Nobody else seemed to want to take the job, and so I took it, and I flatter myself that I made a pretty good job of it. The Germans have an inhuman way of cutting up their verbs. Now a verb has a hard time enough of it in this world when it's all together. It's downright inhuman to split it up. But that's just what those Germans do. They take part of a verb, and put it down here, like a steak, and they take the other part of it, and put it away over yonder like another steak, and between these two limits they just shovel in German. I maintain that there is no necessity for apologizing for a man who helped in a small way to stop such mutilation. We have heard a discussion tonight on the disappearance of literature. That's no new thing. That's what certain kinds of literature have been doing for several years. The fact is, my friends, that the fashion in literature changes, and the literary tailors have to change their cuts, or go out of business. Professor Winchester here, if I remember fairly correctly what he said, remarked that few, if any, of the novels produced today would live as long as the novels of Walter Scott. That may be his notion. Maybe he is right. But so far as I am concerned, I don't care if they don't. Professor Winchester also said something about there being no modern epics like Paradise Lost. I guess he's right. He talked as if he was pretty familiar with that piece of literary work, and nobody would suppose that he never had read it. I don't believe any of you have ever read Paradise Lost, and you don't want to. That's something that you just want to take on trust. It's a classic, just as Professor Winchester says, and it meets his definition of a classic something that everybody wants to have read, and nobody wants to read. Professor Trent also had a good deal to say about the disappearance of literature. He said that Scott would outlive all his critics. I guess that's true. The fact of the business is, you've got to be one of two ages to appreciate Scott. When you're 18 you can read Ivanhoe, and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.